This is Canadian Wealth Wisdom by Trident to Private Wealth. My name is Kyle Taylor, Wealth Advisor and Portfolio Manager. I am joined by Paul Simon, Head of Fixed Income with Trident. Paul has spent 7 years with Trident and previously worked with CIA Investments in a career that spans 25 years. Paul also obtained his CFA designation in 2004. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Kyle. I'm happy to be back.
Well, before we begin, it should be noted that this podcast is intended for general information only and not as specific investment advice. You should always speak to an investment professional to determine the appropriateness of any investment or investment strategy and how it relates to your specific situation. That said, the TriDelta team welcomes a conversation to learn more. The purpose of this series is to discuss recent market developments, what we're watching, and ultimately what action TriDelta is taking within our own client portfolios. Whether it was tariffs, fears of an AI bubble, or geopolitical tensions, 2025 certainly gave investors a lot to consider. Despite everything, it was a remarkable year for gains in virtually all stock and bond markets globally. I want to start with AI, Paul. As the year progressed, the bubble talk got louder. In 2025, AI-related companies actually surpassed U.S. banks in terms of issuances of new bonds. With all the projected spending and companies now taking on debt to finance that spending, is there any concern among bond markets, or and do you feel that investors are being compensated for the risks that things don't work out?
Thanks, Kyle, for the loaded question. I think it's best if we disaggregate it a little bit into its component parts. Of course, bond investors are very concerned with how corporations are using their lending, making sure that they're engaging in profitable exercises. AI is certainly here to stay. The fervor is not unwarranted. There will be meaningful payback from all the investment that's going on right now in terms of increasing revenue and cost minimization. But I saw the reporting you saw as well with respect to how much borrowing is being done by companies to fund AI. The reality is, not to get too technical, but most borrowing that happens in public markets, there are documents that come with it that state many things that lay out borrower obligations and lender rights. And chief among them is what the use of the proceeds of any borrowing would be. And all of these bond deals that we're seeing come to market, even the ones that come from tech companies, generally speaking, have paperwork that says they can use it for general corporate purposes. So a lot of what we're reading in the paper as far as borrowing for AI spending is pretext. The reality is the company will take those proceeds and use it for whatever it sees fit. And as a borrower, you kind of want that anyway. You believe in a company. You want that company to optimize its balance sheet as they move forward and make sure that they're making good decisions within their industries. I would say about AI in general that it really came to prominence in sort of the end of 2022 when ChatGPT was launched. And it was rather fortuitous because it was around that time that we had some problems with venture financing. Everyone remembers what happened with Silicon Valley Bank. So I think that as much as there are meaningful opportunities out there in the real economy for AI implementation, this isn't as much about positioning as anything else. So as a bond investor, you kind of have to look through that marketing angle and try to understand the core business, make sure that companies are still making good decisions in this context. And the best decision a company could have made in 2025, in reality, is to refinance debt it already had. Because we saw policy interest rates come down somewhat, and because credit spreads have narrowed significantly, as I'm sure we'll talk about eventually, it makes sense for a lot of these companies to refinance, whether or not they designated AI borrowing or not. So the business as a bond investor, of a bond investor hasn't changed at all. It's just now we have to be a little bit more mindful of some of the themes that go through the market that maybe provide us opportunities that may not make sense for us.
It's interesting because everybody's talking about, of course, the stock valuations of some of these AI-related names, and that gets all the headlines. But the other side of it is your side, the bond side. And for a lot of these companies, you know, the debt financing is relatively new for a lot of their business structures, where they're going from this, even with the, you know, the infrastructure that they're spending this money on, they're going from relatively asset light to pretty asset heavy, which is a big transition and does carry several risks that we've seen play out before. Now, I know these companies are a lot different than what we saw in the dot-com era, but it does, you know, I think warrant some attention from people for sure.
But this is not atypical. If you're talking about nascent technologies and infant industries, you have to go from ideation to actual implementation. And as you rightly point out, these are capital intensive exercises. there are going to be losers, and there are going to be a lot more losers than winners. But this is the natural progression of an industry when you're in the third or fourth inning. That's not to say that that investment shouldn't be happening. And if anything, I would say that the difference between the, you know, the tech boom of 2000, 2001 versus now is we have a much narrower corporate landscape to begin with. The companies that are doing a lot of this boring are either bulge bracket firms like Oracle or Microsoft, or they're, you know, upstart companies who are growing, like you say, into real bricks and mortar companies who are eventually going to get bought by the big guys anyways, if and when they're actually successful. Of course, there are going to be pitfalls and potential you know, losses and bankruptcies, but that's the normal course of things in growth industries.
Is there the same, you know, one of the things that we had been talking about past several years is that a lot of these big tech companies were sitting on mountains and mountains of cash, and investors were kind of prodding them along to spend some of that cash. Now, of course, they're spending it. They're using debt to finance some of the spending. Is there, you know, you mentioned the big players buying the small players, there'll be winners and losers. Is there the same, you know, my most feared sentence is always this time it's different, but is this time different at all for a lot of the names that are out there and what they're doing with that capital?
So I would say that companies, even though the corporate sector in the United States has never been more flush with cash than it is right now. And you're quite right that investors have been pounding the table in what has been maybe a little less than ideal growth environment for those companies to return that cash to shareholders, mm-hmm. instead of you know, doing whatever they're doing greenfield. Companies aren't dumb. If they can get cheap financing, you know, at near all-time tights in credit spreads and still reasonably low risk-free yields, despite what you're reading in the papers, they're going to deploy leverage themselves anyway to try to boost their own IRRs. And that makes a lot of sense. You want a smart C-suite to be doing that. That's not to say that there isn't going to be some silly behavior. But also, you know, as I was saying before, just be aware that AI is as a pretext, as a marketing brush to be painting all strategies with, is still out there. One of the AI bonds that I saw in the market last year was Kraft Heinz. As far as I know, it's a food company, but they decided that they were going to borrow to use AI to boost their marketing strategies and their production efficiency. I mean, to me, that's just a bricks and mortar company, an old school company that's trying to do what it can to achieve lower boring by attaching the word AI to the offering. So,
not too long ago, everybody was mentioning cannabis in their product lineup to boost novelty, and now it's AI, of course. But it is interesting, and speaking with some people, they're often surprised to learn that companies like Google and Amazon currently have a price-earnings ratio cheaper than Walmart. And even when you look at NVIDIA, which is trading, I think, about 45 times earnings today, Cisco, which was one of the big dot-com darlings and is still around today and is still a fantastic company, but they got as high as 140 times mm-hmm. in 2000 before the bubble burst, of course. So if it is a bubble, maybe it's the early innings of it, but I think that's, you know, a debate that'll continue to be had until something happens.
And I think it's very important to figure out where this company is positioned, like the Cisco's, the Broadcom's, the NVIDIA's, the Oracle's. They're going to be receiving business from other companies who will be spending on AI because they are the providers of the AI technology, the implementers of the AI technology. Whether or not it works out for those companies, those client companies, is of no difference to them.
They've spent the money anyways.
They've spent the money anyways.
And I think that's one of the defining things of 2026 that people will be looking for, is because there is still, you know, a lot of corporate level spending that hasn't really gotten fully on the AI train yet. So that will supposedly continue to funnel this and push this along. But we'll move on. You mentioned spreads, and it is nothing new that spreads are relatively tight, which means that investors generally aren't always being compensated for the risks of the underlying bonds themselves. Do you think that anything on the horizon could change this dynamic and push spreads wider?
We talk about this weekly. I just had this conversation with some of my colleagues. And all I can do in an environment like this is go down the laundry list of things that I've seen in my career. As you quite rightly point out, credit spreads, particularly in the investment grade space, are as tight as they've been in about 18, 19 years, off of a slightly higher risk-free rate base. So the all-ins don't look all that punitive, but certainly much tighter than they ought to be given the assortment of risks that we see on the horizon. The reality is, in the past couple of years, none of these risks or potential risks have really done much to shock the market's appetite for yield product. But if you go down the laundry list, the first and foremost thing you would look for is the likelihood of a recession. We're coming out of 2025 when we had a great number of potential pitfalls whether it be tariffs or geopolitical risks. The reality is that it looks like the global economy will have grown by 3% or thereabouts. The U.S. economy will have grown either side of 2.5, or 2 to 2.5, and the Canadian economy has grown between 1.5 to 2%. All, I would argue, at or near their potential output. So, you know, we can certainly talk about why that is. I think there's lots of reasons for that. But that environment and where we're vaulting off of 2025, into 2026, that environment as you springboard into 2026 doesn't portend to me that anything like a normal course recession is in the offing.
How are you finding opportunities within your models? I know you outperformed your benchmarks in 2025. Bonds in Canada were, you know, 2 to 3%. The U.S. had a good year, but for Canadians, the currency was a detractor. How are you looking at things today?
It's a bit of a dog's breakfast out there, I have to admit. As I say, credit spreads have been tight and moving tighter throughout the year. We did manage to outperform our universes on all of our fixed income models. But that's not because we necessarily got the call right with respect to risk broadly. You know, we have been assessing bond risk in the relative sense, meaning relatively we don't see a whole lot of value there relative to where it ought be given the current economic environment, where we are in the economic cycle, and some of those itemized risks that I mentioned earlier. But we were very opportunistic. We decided that we would stay, you know, further up the curve in high quality credit. We did own a couple of longer dated bonds in our models that performed relatively well. Significant spread tightening in the long end of the curve means much bigger dollar wins for you from a capital gain perspective. And we were able to outperform our universes by doing that. Now that was a lot easier to accomplish coming into 2025 because the yield curve was flatter. You could own shorter dated bonds versus longer dated bonds and not give up as much yield. That's going to be a lot harder to duplicate in 2026. The 2s/10s curve in Canada steepened. The relative rates, risk free rates in those parts of the curve, the difference has gone from 30 basis points to near 90 basis points. So the longer you sit in the front of the curve, the more yield you're giving up. So for an encore, we're probably going to have to be a little bit more opportunistic, deal in newer issues that tend to come at yields with spreads that are more amenable than the existing bonds, deal with some new issuers who tend to come to market a little more cheaper than their cohorts. As long as the environment for credit is going to be constructive, I'd expect those things to continue to do well. And then sort of dabble, I think, in some of the lower rated parts of the investment grade universe. We're in and out of, you know, LRCNs, for example, the, you know, equity-like bond debt that gets issued by Canadian banks and insurance companies. There's some opportunities there. We have been in and out of hybrid bonds, which are sort of the non-financial corporate version of LRCNs. There are some opportunities there as well, but definitely going to have to be more proactive in the market to keep up.
Moving on to everyone's favorite topic is interest rates. It seems that most central banks, including that of Canada, view rates in a relatively good place entering 2026. The U.S. is obviously a notable exception, which was on hold for most of the year and is expected to bring rates down in 2026. I think you were mentioning offline that the expectation is for 2 rate cuts from the U.S. Fed. What are the expectations for you personally on in terms of interest rates, whether that be in Canada or the U.S.?
So just to confirm, yeah, the market's priced in 2 quarter point cuts out of the Fed in 2026, and as of a couple of minutes ago, about 75% likelihood of 1 quarter point hike in Canada from the Bank of Canada. I think the U.S. outlook is probably bang on. The Federal Reserve hung on to its prudent and patient footing for as long as it could in the face of pressure from the executive branch and some noisy data in and around the strength or weakness, depending on how you like to characterize it, of the U.S. economy the back half of last year. But certainly the Fed has inched to an easier positioning, sort of a lower hurdle for easing, despite the fact that inflation hasn't entirely rolled over to their liking. I think it's very obvious to all observers that the executive branch would like something a little bit more dramatic on the easing front. And I think there's a certain segment of the investment markets that believe we can see something more on the order of 1% in total of eases in 2026. I don't think that's going to happen just because the inflation fight isn't over. The Fed's job was made easier in 2025 by the fact that companies seemed willing to absorb some of the tariff-inspired inflation for inputs and the production chain and not pass those on to consumers. I can't imagine that that continues for too much longer. And so I think it's likely a frothy inflation print remaining north of 3 really hamstrings the ability of any Fed to cut, even if the composition of the Fed is materially different. So that's what I think is going to happen down south in Canada. I think our central banker got it right when he said, you know, we're kind of in wait and see. We think this is fair given where inflation is. Canada was way ahead of the Fed. They had eased, I think, we're 150 basis points thereabouts lower in terms of rate structure in the front end than the United States. That's sufficiently accommodative, and the economic data has been better than anyone would have projected given the ongoing tariff spats. So I think it's kind of a clip your coupon year here in Canada. I wouldn't expect anything dramatic one way or the other, ease or hike in 2026. And if it does turn out that the Bank of Canada is hiking, it'll be because there's another inflation scare, and I can promise you that the Bank of Canada won't be the only ones hiking in that context.
Do you think they would have the justification to do so before the renegotiation or the renewal of the USMCA in July?
So what we saw in 2025 from the Bank of Canada was extraordinary patience on both sides of the coin. Back when Liberation Day happened, there were a lot of questions about whether or not the Bank of Canada should act with emergency cuts along those lines. And they said, hey, we have to wait and see how this eventuates. The worst thing we could do is make a policy error and damage our only tool in the event that we actually need to use it for more intentional means later on. So I think we're going to see more patience out of the bank this year. And they're going to be provided some cover because, again, I think the Federal Reserve is easier than the Bank of Canada. And easier monetary conditions in the United States is really good for Canada. And they can just let the Fed do the heavy lifting in the interim. So I wouldn't imagine that the Bank of Canada would be proactive the way that the U.S. executive branch would like the Fed to be.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned that White House kind of influence on the Fed. We've talked about U.S. Fed independence before. The most recent news was on a criminal probe against Chairman Jerome Powell, and that was seen as a further effort to bring down rates. With Powell's term ending in May of this year, how concerned should investors be that this could turn into something even more drastic?
Yeah, interesting times indeed. I'm a little less concerned about the replacement of Powell by any one of the potential nominees that are currently being mentioned in the press. There are four names that I've seen most prominently. One is on the table all the time talking about how we dramatically need to cut rates. Two of them are former Federal Reserve members anyway, who have a very good understanding of the architecture of that institution. And while they might be loud, they know that they're just one vote amongst a number of votes determining policy. I think the biggest concern about the current incursion into the Fed's architecture is that the Fed's credibility has been won over many, many, many years of performance. I certainly have my criticisms of the Federal Reserve, but one thing that the Federal Reserve has shown, as long as I've been in the markets, it's its independence and its reliance on data to determine its courses of action. And the notion that the monetary institution should be directly answerable to the government is the type of thing that really impairs capital formation. The U.S. is the country that issues the reserve currency. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, but the lack of volatility in and around that regime underpins every capital market and every risky asset. And I don't think it's a 2026 story, but the more that it looks like the monetary institution is being married to the federal government, the less likely that we're going to be able to have contained interest rates, particularly in the long end. It's the sort of thing that tends to happen in emerging market countries. And it certainly is not, it certainly is concerning that just recently on the tape I saw that President Trump said that he wants a Federal Reserve governor who would like to cut rates when the economic news is good, which sort of tells me he doesn't really understand how monetary policy works. So definitely it's something we have to monitor. But at the end of the day, I think the Fed is a very old and venerable institution. Lots of voices in there who are already out there defending their turf, so to speak. And I think while at the margin you might end up with an easier Fed than otherwise should be, given the data, I don't think you're going to see anything along the lines of what's being hoped for in the executive branch.
I saw something interesting today that it was a hypothetical around, so Powell, you know, is no longer chairman after May 2026, but he's still entitled to a spot as a governor until 2028. And mm-hmm. that would be funny just to think about him just keeping that spot to stick it to President Trump, which didn't seem too likely, but he's been pretty outspoken recently. So who knows? Staying on the U.S., the U.S. dollar had a really difficult first half of the year. It was the worst year for the U.S. dollar in some time. I think the dollar fell around 11% that first half. It recovered modestly in the second half of 2025. Is there an expectation that you hold for the U.S. dollar from here?
I think my outlook on the U.S. dollar is sort of twofold. I think there's the fundamental case, and then there's the geopolitical risk case, which would put you in contrary positions. Just looking back at 2025, I think what happened there was, coming into the year, most of the developed market countries had cut rates aggressively, getting ahead of what they saw was weakening momentum coming out of the COVID lockdowns and associated disruptions in the economies. And the U.S. was late to that party, and the U.S. dollar had remained stronger as a result, having a higher interest rate structure as well as perceived to be by far the economic outperformer and leader. Coming into 2025, we saw that wasn't necessarily the case. There was some weakness in the U.S. economy. There was a lot of attention being paid to deterioration in the labor markets. And then you layer on top of that the ongoing tariff fight and some of the perceived big shifts in the relationship between governments, the corporate sector, and trade partners. All of that is relatively bearish for the U.S. dollar, and that just happened to be timed up with the Fed, who actually cried uncle and said, we do need to ease rates to help underpin the economy as things are slowing down. And so you saw over the year, not just the back, getting back to the back, coming back to the pack economic performance and interest rate policy of the U.S. regime, but also a sort of invest anywhere else but the United States. At a time when, you know, the U.S. wasn't necessarily playing nice with its partners. That was very much the theme in 2025. I think a lot of those themes are in place for 2026 and then some. We're about to get a ruling out of the Supreme Court vis-a-vis whether or not President Trump's emergency tariffs are lawful or not. And no matter what is ruled there, there's going to be ongoing legal wranglings about that and uncertainty about the regime in which you operate in the United States. We've got an upcoming budget fight for sure. The last time they did this was a short-term solution. They're going to need a longer-term one. And all of that negotiating is going to be happening in the context of an impending midterm election that looks like it's going to be very hotly contested and not so good for the incumbent parties. So all of that, I think, speaks to the potential for further U.S. dollar weakness. And the one thing that no one really ever talks about is that we have a sitting president who very often in his private life and in his, you know, his governmental service life has said he likes a weak U.S. dollar as a means of juicing the economy through the external sector. So I'm not entirely sure that he minds that the U.S. dollar is deteriorating the way it does if it means you can sort of beggar thy neighbor through the export markets. So I think all of that fundamentally means that the U.S. dollar ought to be weak. All that being said, we saw what happened with the U.S. incursion into Venezuela. Despite the fact that that's a U.S.-centric geopolitical risk, the U.S. dollar rallies in environments like that because of its safe haven properties. So my answer would be I expect more U.S. dollar weakness. However, I'm very carefully monitoring headlines for snapbacks in the U.S. dollar in the event that we have more of the geopolitical risk that we've seen in recent weeks.
The other side of a weakening U.S. dollar, of course, is that the Canadian dollar has mildly outperformed, but remains close to being actually one of the weakest major currencies out there. Can you get into the reasons behind this?
Sure. So, I mean, the Canadian dollar really had to fight back in the back half of last year, and I think eventually did catch the broader basket of currencies versus the U.S. dollar, but you're right, it's definitely underperformed its G7 peers vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar. I mean, the Canadian dollar story, I think, is fairly consistent, well understood to be persistent underperformance in terms of growth. I mean, the Canadian economy has done better than expected given its challenges, but still growing in the mid ones when the rest of the world is growing 2-3% is always a challenge. The lower interest rate structure, of course, means that Canadian dollar denominated yield assets aren't nearly as attractive. And then you layer on top of that the thematic issue from the foreign investor perspective of the ongoing spat with its largest trading partner. Those things don't play well for the Canadian dollar. But I do think the Canadian dollar fundamentally is better positioned than is currently priced in the market. I don't know that it's meaningfully going to catch up to some of its other partners, other competitors rather, in the G7 space. But my guess is that the Canadian dollar will probably perform in line with the DXY this year, as opposed to, you know, underperforming then outperforming as it did throughout 2025.
Good to know. So it could be a little bit cheaper to go to the U.S.
Yeah,
so that's good to know. That's good news. Thanks again for joining me, Paul. For any listeners who have not yet already read our Q4 2025 market commentary, I would encourage you to visit the Insights page on our website. That concludes this recording of Canadian Wealth Wisdom, and more specifically, our quarterly market update series. Thank you.